In this weekend's episode, two segments from this past week's Washington Journal. First, author and free speech advocate Greg Lukianoff, president and CEO of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, discusses the rise of anti-Semitism on college campuses. Then, Washington Post intelligence and national security reporter Shane Harris discusses his partnership with PBS Frontline on the new documentary, The Discord Leaks.
Hi, I'm Robin, C-SPAN's media relations specialist, and I'd like to tell you about a new effort on our part. We're asking our listeners to help support C-SPAN's nonprofit operations. It's easy to do. Look for the donate button on our website, cspan.org. Your financial support allows us to offer our unfiltered coverage of Washington, history, and nonfiction books everywhere people are consuming news and information these days. Our cable networks, the web, a mobile app, daily newsletters, and of course, C-SPAN Radio, and our mini podcast, please consider supporting that effort by making a tax-exempt donation today. Visit cspan.org/donate, and thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
First, Greg Lukianoff, president and CEO of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, on free speech issues in the news.
So, we have been talking this morning about the intersection of free speech.
Yes.
And college campuses and censorship.
That's in the news?
And congressional hearings and college presidents resigning. One of the things we learned this morning is that your organization rated Harvard 248th
yes.
in free speech out of 248. Why did they get a rating and what were the criteria?
Yeah, it's funny because Harvard initially responded like this was just our guess. And it's like, no, it's based on the largest survey of student opinion on freedom of speech ever conducted, plus the largest database of professor cancellations, student cancellations, deplatforming, and speech codes. And when we put it all together, Harvard got a negative score. It got the only negative score in FIRE's history. So it really earned its dead last place.
And what were the criteria that you would use? You looked at teacher cancellation?
Yeah, professor cancellation.
Professor
yeah.
cancellation. What does that mean?
That means that if someone gets suspended for their speech, if a tenured professor gets fired for their speech, that's a big ding on them. It means whether or not their policies live up to constitutional First Amendment standards, and we hold that private schools that promise freedom of speech to the same standard. We ask students, are they comfortable having arguments with each other? Also, we ask them, are you comfortable with shouting down speakers? And we evaluate all of those versus each other. And, Michigan Technological University did great. University of Virginia did really well. University of Chicago did really well. Every Ivy League school did terribly.
Why do you think that is?
I remember being in Boston and having an incredulous MIT student say, it's like, well, it can't possibly be that these Ivy League schools are that much worse. I'm like, and I was just like, no, dear, I'm so sorry. I've been doing this 22 years. They absolutely are. A lot of the sort of anti-free speech ideology is frankly more concentrated in particularly the most prestigious schools. And it's not a subtle effect at all in my experience.
In your view, Greg Lukianoff, as president and CEO of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, should students be allowed to protest on college campuses and say out loud, from the sea to the river?
From the river to the sea. I understand the argument that that is a call for genocide, but there was an interesting article with someone actually asking students if they knew what it meant. They actually showed them the map about here's the river, here's the sea. And once they actually saw that it meant, you know, Israel kind of wiped off the map, they started to not be for it. So from a First Amendment standpoint, there's no question that from the river to the sea is protected. However, any speech, including that, in certain contexts, can actually be threats. It can be discriminatory harassment. It can be even incitement to violence under specific circumstances. But is shouting intifada, for example, or saying from the river to the sea by itself protected? Absolutely.
You have a law degree from Stanford. Where does Stanford rate?
Stanford did not do great. It was in the bottom half. I do have a little bit of hope for Stanford, though, because Jenny Martinez, the former dean of Stanford Law School, really fought back after there was a very embarrassing shout down of Fifth Circuit Judge Kyle Duncan last spring. We were very embarrassed by this, the alumni, that is. But what Jenny has done so far is actually advocate for, you know, political neutrality at Stanford. She's talked about, you know, shout downs are not okay. The administrator who was involved in that has been asked not to return to Stanford, and they promoted her to provost. So I have some hope that Stanford's on a better trajectory.
The Wall Street Journal this morning says that the Ivy League mask has fallen. This is the title of their op-ed. But they say the great benefit of last week's performance by three elite school presidents before Congress is that it tore the mask off the intellectual and political corruption of much of the American academy. Now, that's a little bit out of your free speech bailiwick, but what do you think about that?
Well, it was hard to. The biggest fear that comes out of the hearings is that university presidents are going to take the message that we have to clamp down on protected speech more in the name of preventing offensive speech. But meanwhile, you know, the decision of the University of Pennsylvania president to step down, there's no way a free speech person can lament that, because one of the things that happened right before President McGill stepped down is she said, you know what, we're going to abandon constitutional standards as informing our policies. And University of Pennsylvania, by the way, was second to last on our ratings. So am I concerned about what message future university presidents take from this? Yes. At the same time, is their free speech record at Ivy League schools at least defensible? It also isn't.
Now, we've been reading about donors pulling money, withholding money, unless this happens.
Yeah.
Is that a fair tactic?
I think that a lot of these schools have felt entitled to the $100 million that a lot of these people have, and of course they're not. And I have a serious issue, however, with donors if they're demanding professors be punished or students be punished for speech. However, if what they're saying is we need to remove impediments to speech, and some of them are saying this, we need to get rid of some of the one of the complaints about DEI offices, for example, is that they're conformity sort of inducing institutions. And unfortunately, I've seen a fair amount of evidence of that. The administrator at Stanford who was involved in that shout-down was a DEI administrator. One of the cases that we talked about at Harvard involving Carol Hooven involved a DEI graduate student. And it's the same thing repeated over and over again. We've also seen this, you know, problem at Yale. So I think that talking about the mask falling off, you know, we need serious reform in higher education. Even if you're just concerned about cost, we need serious reform. And when it comes to freedom of speech, you need a lot of steps here. And I think that the argument that I've been getting increasingly worried about, and the one we talk about in Canceling of the American Mind, is finally breaking through to some people who didn't realize it had become this strange on campus.
Greg Lukianoff, these are private institutions.
Yes.
They can make their own rules, can't they?
They can, but almost all of them promise freedom of speech and academic freedom. In California, actually private non-sectarian universities are required to live up to First Amendment standpoints as a condition of taking money. So Stanford is actually technically required to live up to First Amendment standards. It's not an official position of FIRE that should be a national law, but as we see schools actually voluntarily saying that they're no longer going to live up to First Amendment standards, people should ask themselves, like, is it then, should they be getting all this federal money?
Should Twitter have been allowed to cancel a U.S. president from its website? And should X be allowed to put Alex Jones back on its website?
So when it comes to freedom of association, one thing that we do support at FIRE is that social media companies have the right to make their own rules. They have a freedom of association right to be, to work, function essentially as editors of their platforms. So we definitely think that they, but that doesn't mean there are no free speech implications to some of this. Could they remove Trump? Absolutely. That is within their powers to do. Now, of course, the argument is that, yes, but he's also a sitting president of the United States, it's probably valuable to know what he really says and thinks, which I'm sympathetic to. When it comes to Alex Jones, the argument against Alex Jones is not about protected speech, it's about defamation. I'm from Danbury. I had a friend who used to come to my parties at my house all the time who lost a kid at Newtown. And if that wasn't defamation of multiple parents to say that they were paid actors faking that their children had been killed, really nothing is. So I think the justification for kicking Alex Jones, off the off of X was actually pretty strong. Still, is it within X's powers to decide to do that? Of course.
What's FIRE's relationship to the ACLU?
I'm an old ACLU guy myself. I worked there in 1999. Nadine Strossen, the former head of the ACLU, is actually a senior fellow who I'm very honored that I get to write with sometimes. She's one of my heroes, and it's amazing to get to work with her. Ira Glasser, the former executive director of FIRE, of the ACLU, is on our advisory committee. We work with them whenever we have cases where we're on the same page. We're happy to work together.
So, people sometimes consider you to be a conservative organization and ACLU to be the liberal organization?
Yeah.
Is that a fair assessment?
No, FIRE is not a conservative organization. We never have been. I mean, our staff leans more to the left than to the right. But regardless of that, if you look at our record, if it's a free speech case, we defend it. We defend it without apologies, without condemning the speech that we're defending. We are striving to be the real deal when it comes to defending free speech all across the spectrum. And for the most part, if people make this accusation, they just show that they don't know very much about us.
That was Greg Lukianoff, president and CEO of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression.
This episode is supported by FX's Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped, streaming June 4th, only on Hulu.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Next, Washington Post intelligence and national security reporter Shane Harris discusses his partnership with PBS Frontline on the new documentary, The Discord Leaks. The film examines the story of how classified Pentagon information wound up on that gaming platform by a 21-year-old member of the Massachusetts Air National Guard.
So who is Jack Teixeira? Tell us about him.
Yeah, so he is 21 years old. He was a technician in the Air National Guard in Massachusetts, a computer technician. He worked at Otis Air Force Base, or Air National Guard Base, I should say, and an intelligence office that basically was responsible for doing things like processing drone footage and satellite imagery from various conflicts or work the U.S. military is doing overseas. Grew up there in Massachusetts, was a bright kid, fascinated in the military and military history, so a job in the military seemed really well suited for him. He was also very interested in video games since he was a young kid, and this becomes a very important part of his biography because as he gets older and during the pandemic, he increasingly is spending a lot of his time and most of his free time in some cases on a gaming platform called Discord, which is essentially a big chat platform that lets people talk to each other while they're playing video games in real life. This is the place where he makes his close friends during the pandemic and ultimately starts sharing with them classified information that he has access to because of the facility where he works as a computer technician. So someone who You know, we get into this in the film of the decisions that led him down this road of starting to share this classified information. But somebody who, by all accounts, had a potentially bright future ahead of him in the military, where he was getting to sort of satisfy his interests in military history and operations as well as computers because he was working with them every day.
So then tell us, what led him down that path and how many documents did he end up sharing?
Yeah, it's a surprising turn of events, and I have to say that in my career covering intelligence and leaks, this was unique to me. I'm used to individuals who have access to classified information sharing it with the press because they think there's some kind of government wrongdoing or they want to expose malfeasance as they see it. Teixeira was sharing this information ultimately because he wanted to impress his friends, which sounds like a very strange thing to do. But from a really early age, it seems that he had what I describe as kind of a pedantic nature. He enjoyed knowing information and trivia and the arcane aspects of military history and operations and sharing that with people and sometimes even lecturing them about that. Friends we spoke to who played video games with him from a young age said he really insisted on calling the weapons that people played with in games by their actual technical names and being very precise about this. So someone for whom knowing things and information made him feel powerful, made him feel strong. And then when the war in Ukraine begins, he's made these very close friends in the pandemic on these Discord servers, these chat rooms that he's in. And he wants to start telling them about this massive event that is unfolding in the news. And the way that he does that is by sharing with them classified battlefield assessments and updates that he is able to get at work. Now, he's not supposed to be reading these things, we should emphasize. He is a computer technician. He's not an analyst. But he has a top secret clearance, which essentially lets him get into the files that he's only supposed to be maintaining and kind of keeping up. And he's taking this information, he's writing it down, in some cases he's removing documents, and taking it home and sharing it with his friends, I think, honestly, to make himself feel important and to make himself feel big and strong because he knew things that they didn't.
Were you able to talk to him for this, for your reporting?
No, we couldn't. He declined through his lawyers our interview request, and he's currently in jail in Massachusetts waiting trial on 6 felony counts, so we could not speak to him, and his family also declined to speak with us.
And as far as what's in the documents and how much of a, I guess, how important they were national security, what can you tell us? Was it only about Ukraine and battlefield assessments?
No. What really makes these leaks so interesting is the breadth of them. It was about Ukraine. There was information about North Korea, Iran, China, other aspects of Russia, parts of Latin America. I mean, we're talking kind of the whole panoply of information that the U.S. intelligence is collecting on a daily basis, and these kind of intakes that come in the form of reports, updates, bulletins, briefing slides, all information that is shared throughout the intelligence community for people who might need it for their job. And he was able to just sort of go in and sample this as he wanted to read it. He'd think he took at least, you know, several hundred documents, printed documents, and then it's harder to count, but a larger body of information that he wrote down as notes and then typed into chat rooms almost verbatim in many cases of reports that he was reading. So it's a really astonishing amount, but also the breadth of it is what is so striking. And it's current. This was information that was up-to-the-minute intelligence reporting on events that were unfolding as he was describing them to people.
So I guess the question is, why does a computer technician have access to this kind of information?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it surprises so many people. After the 9/11 attacks, the intelligence community underwent this profound change in how it handled classified information. We'll remember that one of the reasons for the attacks was that so many intelligence agencies in the government weren't talking with one another about what they knew. The FBI didn't know what the CIA knew or what the NSA was collecting. After 9/11, they switched from what was called the need to know, which is how you determined who got access to classified information. Did you need to know it for your specific job? To what they call a need to share. The idea being, let's take all of this intelligence and make it broadly available to people who might need it in ways that we can't anticipate, we being, you know, the senior policymakers in government. So someone who has a top secret security clearance like he did gets access to computer networks where all of that information is maintained. So that's how he gets in and can see it. He's not supposed to be looking at it. He can't help but encounter it because he's working on the computer systems and maintaining them and keeping them running. But that's how someone at his very low level is able to get access to information that people at much higher levels can get who need to see it.
Now, I want to ask you about the process for him getting that top secret clearance, mm-hmm. because he had some things happen in his past that, you know, reasonable people might call red flags.
Yeah.
So I'm going to play a clip for you real quick of his former girlfriend talking about, you know, what the military might find in that investigation for the security clearance.
He was a little bit worried they were going to, in their interview, bring up, hey, we found this Discord account or we found this Discord server. At that time, he did become less active in Discord. And he was very worried about keeping the things he was doing private and safe.
What was he specifically worried that the background investigation might turn up with regards to Discord?
There was a lot of, like, racist talk on that server. There was a lot of talk of killing ATF agents, killing different government officials, committing acts of terrorism. Things that are probably not great for someone in the military to be saying. So I think that's probably what he was worried about.
The military to be saying is
right.
Kind of an understatement.
Right, it is.
And really, this server that these kids were all hanging out in, where Jack DeShera was the leader of this group of mostly teenage boys, was rife with racist language, racist jokes, anti-Semitic comments, pictures of gore. I mean, the kinds of things that I think many of them, maybe these kids, you know, to be charitable to them, were sort of saying this to try to get a rise out of people. I think some of them actually believed it, and I think DeShera is in that category. But things that if a military background investigator saw this might think, why are you spending so much time saying these things? Why are you joking, if you're in fact joking, about making threats to kill ATF agents? What is this hostility that you are showing towards the U.S. government that you now want to join by military service? And what's important to note here is that background investigators never see this part of his online life, because when you go through the process of getting a security clearance, you're not required to disclose your social media activity, the accounts like Discord where you may have a presence. They go and investigate and interview people in your real life, your neighbors, your friends, maybe your coworkers. Jack DeShera, his life was online. That's where all his friends were. Those were his contacts and his associates. The FBI, the background investigators, they never interview people like that.
Any indication that because of this case that they might start looking at people's online life?
It's possible. We're already seeing from the Defense Department statements that they need to tighten up on their internal controls around securing information. What we've seen just in the past day or so, though, is an Air Force Inspector General report come out into these particular leaks at the base where he worked that faulted the security clearance process and said that there was negative information, as they called it, that came up in the course of his background investigation that was never shared with the supervisors at his unit where he worked in Massachusetts. And the inspector general concluded that had they done that, people there, supervisors there, likely would have put him under closer scrutiny. And when he did start looking at appropriately classified information, might say, hold on, this kid also has other red flags in his past. Maybe we need to take more aggressive action here about what he's doing.
And what about the platform itself, Discord? Why didn't they, I guess once they realized he was sharing classified documents, why didn't they take it down?
Well, ultimately, they didn't know he was sharing them. And this is really the way that Discord is set up. The analogy that their executive used, I think it's a good one, is Discord is sort of like a city. And every one of these servers is kind of like a house. It's a place that the individual sets up. And that person decides who comes in, who gets kicked out. It's an invitation-only kind of architecture. And so this place that DeShera and his friends set up, the company Discord does not actually monitor what's going on inside that house. They don't have security cameras, if you like, or listening devices. That's a choice that the company has made. It's not a technological obstacle they can't overcome. They could monitor them if they wanted to. But they've made a choice to value user privacy and to give people spaces where they're not being monitored. This has become an issue for them, though, because Discord has really become a hotbed where extremists and other kind of radical groups organize, experts say, because they know they're not being monitored by the company. And it's easier for them to share the kind of rhetoric that DeShera and his friends were sharing or to organize to do things in real life.
And we have another clip from the documentary. This is now the VP of Trust and Safety for Discord defending the platform.
Look, the Unite the Right rally was a really challenging moment for Discord. I was not part of the company at that time, but it was the impetus for Discord to build a trust and safety team. We have 150 million people using Discord every month, right? That's billions of interactions, right? So the scale of this challenge is immense.
The company has defended itself in the wake of the intelligence leaks and the ongoing problems with extremism, saying they represent isolated bad actors on a platform designed for privacy and community.
We have taken the stance that a lot of these spaces are like text messaging your friends and your loved ones, and it's inappropriate for us to violate people's privacy, and we don't have the level of precision to do so when it comes to detection. To me, this is, we're a city, right? Discord is a city, right? We have all these people who are trying to find friends in their city, and they're going and, you know, playing sports, right? They might be gaming, they might be, you know, studying together. In any city, you are going to have problematic pockets.
And that's at Discord. How long did it take for the DOD, the FBI, once they started seeing these documents come up on the web, how long did it take them to find out who it was and arrest Teixeira?
That part didn't take very long. The documents were proliferating out of this original Discord server into the broader internet for about 4 or 5 weeks before the Pentagon noticed. And when they did, they alerted the FBI. It really only took FBI agents about a week to find Jack Teixeira, and they traced him through his Discord account. They were able to go to the company and essentially say, we need you to give us information for a law enforcement investigation. And I should say, too, you know, people we talked to credited the Discord with responding very quickly to the FBI once they understood what was actually going on the platform, which nobody really understood while it was happening. That's a pretty remarkable amount of time, 1 week, for the FBI to find the leaker. Usually, people who leak classified information, they're often not discovered. But the issue here was, I think, that prior to that arrest, there was no practical way for Discord, and they talk about this in the film, to understand that there were classified documents moving through their system. They don't scan for that. And as they said, you know, we wouldn't even know how to begin to scan for classified documents unless somebody tells us this is what a classified document looks like, or this is the one you need to look for.
And any indication of what the impact was to national security because of those document leaks?
Well, the fallout, I think, was significant in a number of ways. Probably most so that it really exposed, particularly through the Ukraine war intelligence reporting, that privately U.S. officials had a very dim view of the likelihood of success of the counteroffensive in Ukraine, which is playing out right now. And in fact, you know, President Zelensky is coming to Washington this week because support is waning for this war in Ukraine because so many lawmakers feel that it is not going the direction that the U.S. hoped. The documents show that U.S. officials essentially knew that this was likely to be the outcome, while publicly they were much more optimistic and bullish about the prospects. There were real strains between the U.S. and our allies by these leaks because it exposed so much information that allies are both sharing with the U.S. and in some cases that the U.S. is monitoring the communications of its allies. And I have to say, there was some information in the documents that we simply chose not to publish because it was far too specific about individual sources, in some cases human sources, spies, who were passing information to the U.S. or their allies that if it had been made public, conceivably those people's lives could have been in danger. So this was a lot of very deeply sensitive information. And when we reported on it, we took steps at every time to make sure we were talking to the government about exactly what we were preparing to report, what was in these documents, and making decisions when we felt it was necessary to withhold some information.
That was Shane Harris, intelligence and national security reporter for The Washington Post and correspondent on the new PBS Frontline documentary, The Discord Leaks. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program on our website at cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern Time.